point to the pilot. The pilot is simply a helper, okay? And what that does is it actually helps the receiver's phase lock loop put the tuner at the right frequency. It does nothing for data demodulation. Let me reset the repeater. Hang on a minute. Why don't you talk for a second, Dick?
Okay. The 8 VSB, I have the impression that there are... levels of possible instantaneous amplitude. Are all of those done at the exact same phase, or is there some phase modulation that can take place simultaneously, a little bit like a 16 QAM? Is it an 8 QAM signal is what I guess I'm sort of asking. Over to you, Eric.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater clock 9 set.
Negative. It is an 8-step analog signal, but because there is data randomization and a bunch of other things going on, I mean, it's a multi-step thing. Let me give you a quick rundown in this order, alright? Let me drop.
If I had a properly calibrated constellation diagram test set, and I look at an 8 VSB signal,
thank you for visiting.
What would it look like?
Local Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Go ahead, hook it up again, Benny. Oh, well, I'll get to it. It would not look like what you would expect for, the constellation would not look like what you would expect to see for QAM. Or for 16 QAM or the 64 QAM. Doesn't look like that at all. It lines up the constellation of this, looks like 8 straight vertical lines as opposed to dots that are spaced equally in both X and Y.
The 8 vertical lines, on an ordinary constellation diagram test set, I could call the horizontal axis the I and the vertical axis the Q. In the 8 vertical lines on that particular constellation diagram test set, what is the definition of the horizontal axis and the vertical axis? Go ahead.
One is I, one is Q. In the case of 8 VSB, the Q is useless and it's basically thrown away. It's only the I that has information in it.
Okay. So the vertical lines fill up all possible Q magnitudes. I guess you're telling me all of the modulations mixed together are creating the random variable that makes all possible phases, but they're not synchronized in the normal way of a 16 QAM, is what I think you're saying. Go ahead.
That is correct. That's absolutely correct. Let me take you through this real fast. The first thing an 8 VSB signal has to do, the receiver has to do, is it has to take the MPEG-2 data packet and uses that to synchronize its own internal clock. Okay, before any signal processing can occur, an 8 VSB exciter has got to correctly identify the start and start points, the start and stop points of each MPEG-2 data packet. Okay, and that's accomplished with a sync byte. As I told you before, it's 188 bytes in length. The first byte of each packet is always a sync byte, all right? In the receiver, what happens is the sync byte discards it gets replaced with something else later. All right, the next thing it does is it has to randomize the data. With the exception of the sync stuff, okay, the 8BS stream, 8BSB stream has to have completely random noise-like, it has to be completely random noise-like in nature. Okay, and the reason for that is the transmitted signal frequency response has to have a flat noise-like spectrum in order for the allotted channel to use the space with maximum efficiency. You okay with that so far?
Yes, I think I understand. That's the mechanism of making the Bartz head display on a spectrum analyzer. And that in theory gives you the highest possible efficiency of the spectrum that's been allocated to that particular channel. Go ahead.
Okay. If we had reoccurring patterns, it would cause the RF energy to kind of lump together at certain points, and we wouldn't have the flat thing, we'd have holes in it. You're okay with that, right?
Oh, yes, I am. So you don't have a spectral signature per se. It is a pure, randomized, Bart's head haircut. Go ahead.
Correct. Okay. There's a data randomizer, which is changed according to a pseudo-random number generator, which is a known pattern, and the receiver reverses that when it takes it apart, so it knows where to take it apart. So after that, we do some Reed-Solomon encoding. You know what that is. It's kind of like an FEC scheme, right?
Forward error correcting type of a code. And by the way, in order for those pseudo-random codes to be properly aligned, if this is the best of all possible worlds, somewhat like a cell site base station, you would like that synchronization to be from a perfect clock where both clocks are synchronized to a GPS. I suspect that the real receiver is doing some form of local clock generation and doesn't require anywhere near the accuracy of GPS. Go ahead.
That's correct. It takes the sync bytes and uses that to run a thought later. It's freewheel, but if you know, with any data separator, you can make a data separator out of 2JK flip-flops. You can get I and Q out of it. Out of a pair of them. And that's what it uses to run the whole scheme. So it has to kind of figure out what the sync byte is, which is actually a fixed value number, which repeats itself.
When you do synchronize the local clock, is there a way of describing the spectral purity requirement of that local clock in order to get reasonably clean demodulation?
Yeah, there is, and there is a limit. And what we do is we call it the PCR clock. It went out of my head. I have to look for the name of it. The breakdown of it. It's the program clock reference. I'm not positive of the acronym. I'll come across it in a minute. But anyway, once you've extracted the clock, then you can start to take the rest of the stuff apart. And the Reed-Solomon, of course, if it starts to see errors, it will recover them based upon the little, let's call it a parity byte in the end. Reed-Solomon can only do so much, so there's actually more stuff going on. The next thing we have after that is something called a data interleaver. The interleaver disturbs the sequential order of the data stream, and it disperses the data throughout time, and actually it's about 4.5 milliseconds, in order to minimize the transmitted signal sensitivity to burst type interference. Right? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it sounds a little bit close to what in the electronic countermeasures world is called, all of a sudden the words went out of my head, CSB, Contiguous Subcarrier Barrage. If I've got a voltage-controlled oscillator that's sweeping from frequency A to frequency B, and it's doing it at a certain rate, I'm going to make a whole bunch of individual spectral lines that are equivalent to the rate. If I'm sweeping 50,000 times per second, I'm going to have a spectral line every 50 kilohertz. If I now introduce random noise that jitters each of those lines by more than 50 kilohertz so that they flow into each other, I generate a Bart's head. I think you're telling me the data scheme is doing something similar to contiguous subcarrier barrage. Go ahead.
Okay, the way I remember it is sort of like putting all your eggs, instead of putting them in one basket, you put your eggs in many different baskets, and if you get like a burst of noise and punches a hole in the signal, so you're really losing the contents of one basket for that particular burst, but you have, many different segments in the different baskets. You're only losing one egg instead of a whole data segment. You can figure it, you can put it back together. I think they call it time diversity.
Seems like it has a little bit of the characteristics of MIMO. You're telling me the clock gets synchronized primarily by the sync pulses. where in that crazy spectrum are the sync pulses hidden?
Well, you have to think of it as a sync word as opposed to a sync pulse. Okay, and yeah, a burst of noise can disturb it, but it happens every 4.5 milliseconds, so it's continuously repeated, and it will catch it at some point. So this particular word, that might be an FF, or it might, I forget what it is, it's actually a particular value. And every time that comes by, it knows that that's the start of a block. Right? So, from that information, you start to, what you do is you phase lock your clock. And for that 4.5 milliseconds, that clock is freewheeling, and every time it sees an edge, that it, you know, decodes that as data one way or the other. That, in turn, after you've gotten that data interleaving done, and you extract it, okay, now we've got something called a trellis encoder. A trellis encoder is yet another form of kind of FEC, different than Reed Solomon, which treats the entire packet simultaneously as a block. So now here's another form of forward error correction, but over that whole 4.5 millisecond period as opposed to an instantaneous point in time. Trellis coding is kind of, you can think of it as an evolving code to kind of track. It kind of tracks the progress of a stream as it develops through time. It's sort of like finding the past history of the data that's been sent. Actually, if I remember right, Trellis, each 8-bit byte is split up into 4 2-bit words. Each 2-bit word is compared to the previous history of another 2-bit word. Let me let it drop. And the symbol is actually a 3-bit binary. And that's generated over the, from a transition from the previous 2-bit word to the current one. So, these 3-bit codes are substituted to the original 2-bit words and transmitted over the air as 8-level symbols of 8BSD. Whereas 3 bits is equal to 23, which is 8 combinations of levels. Okay, so every 2 bits that go into the trellis encoder, 3 bits come out, and that way the, if you've ever dealt with the, what they do with satellites and stuff like that, the trellis coder is similar to what we use in satellites. It's called a 2-3 rate coder. 2 bits in, 3 bits out. From that, the trellis decoder can look at the previous 2-bit word and figure out that the next 3-bit word is correct, or if there's an error, and if there's an error, it can figure out what it was based on the previous input.
Is there a simple way of describing the error rate that is tolerable and the data can be properly reconstructed?
Well, there's actually six numbers in which I can get you the exact numbers in terms of what the ranges are. It's in, what is it? It's in let's see, the satellites they use in millions of bits. I'm not sure what they call it, but they have a specific range of errors that the receiver will tolerate. Once you go outside of that, you get pixelated and break up.
Way back in the dark ages, when you first started studying the Spagnoli material, explaining the methods of operation of 8VSD, from the time you very first started studying it until you got to close to today's level of understanding, roughly how big an investment was that for Eric Spiegel?
Trust me, it took a long while, and I'm still kind of fuzzy on some parts of it, but at least I understand the math of it at this point. And the equalizer is a very funny thing, because if you've ever actually looked at the algorithms that they use, it started out being very simple and didn't work very well. It's gotten so sophisticated now, I think very few people understand the whole methodology.
Although you didn't do it at one sitting or one course, so to speak, it was an intermittent study that you've done. But would I be correct in assuming that intermittently you've been studying this for more than 3 years to get to where you are?
Well, let's put it this way. Our first transmitter we put up in 1998.
Okay. And I think you did that at World Trade Number 1. 1998. Wow. But you started studying this a couple of years before that, and that particular transmitter was a purchased item. Maybe you didn't have to have complete understanding of its method of operation at the time of installation. That's a guess on my part. Go ahead.
No, I actually had taken a couple of courses before it got put in, but, you know, at that point, they were still figuring out how to teach the course.
Was Spagnoli writing the curriculum material?
Not at that point. He hadn't left Zenith yet, but he was now creating what you saw of that thick book. That's when it started.
Is he the major creator of this overall scheme? Is he the father of ATSC almost? Obviously, he had a lot of help from a lot of other people. But if you had to give any one individual the majority of the credit, is he the man?
Funny thing is, he doesn't take the credit, but he's the guy.
You've met him on how many occasions, and would you consider him a geek?
He's actually quite a character. He's really funny. He's well-rounded. Just looking at him, you wouldn't think that he was a geek, but the knowledge in the man's head is incredible. And yet, you know, you can be stupid and still have an intelligent conversation with him.
Sounds like a fun guy to be around. My son spent the last week and a half at Columbia University, where they held a yearly conference in the United States this year of the people that are into free source code like Unix, and something like 100, maybe it was 120 people from something like 15 countries in the world all gathered at the one spot to discuss their favorite subject, all of the various versions and coding techniques for Unix software. And my son, who is pretty heavy into that for the last 5 years, told me that he was definitely outgeeked. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, tell him to go to SIGGRAPH. He'll have a good time. I've got to remember when I used to work for the New York Tech in the computer graphics lab, those guys were, they didn't have one degree. I mean, Tracy had, he has a doctorate in mathematics, a doctorate in computer science, a doctorate in musicology, and also a doctorate in physics. But that's how crazy these guys were.
KC2QAQ.
He'd be a fun guy to ask what corona breakdown looks like. You got it, Glenn.
I think I've got the answer that you're looking for, Dick. It's actually in the thing called inelastic collisions. Inelastic collisions with kinetic energy are basically based on certain positions of the valence energy of electrons available in the molecules of air. What basically happens is you certainly have you have a certain amount of kinetic energy available to have collisions before a breakdown in corona buildup. And what's basically happening is as the air pressure is increasing, the volume of air is becoming more densely packed. And what it's doing is it's limiting the angle of kinetic energy between the valence energies. Because what will happen is in lower air pressures, the spacing between the valence electrons is at a wider ratio, and the angles of collisions can take place easier in lighter air pressures. In heavier air pressures, the valence energy electrons are tighter packed, giving them less overall inelastic collision. So in other words, you want more elastic collision to give you more breakdown capability, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What this all gets down to, as I see it, is that I'm building a minimum energy particle accelerator. There's some particular velocity required for the particles that I'm accelerating that when they smash into whatever I call target, if the velocity is too low, they just simply bounce. The electron cloud from one sees the electron cloud from the other, and they have a perfect impact and repulsion, if you know what I mean, like a vertically bouncing ball. When you reach that minimum velocity, your accelerated particle penetrates that outer electron cloud, and now I am guessing that your nuclei get a chance to hit each other, or at least some of the electrons get down to hitting the nucleus, and now you get some kind of a breakup, and now you're going to really see individual things come out of there that you can analyze. There is some minimum velocity required to do that, depending on what materials I'm using. You try to Google that and try to find out what that minimum velocity is. And it's somewhat like what's going on with these electrons that I'm accelerating in my E field. What's that minimum velocity required so when the impact occurs, it creates ionization to go the next step in using the, in carrying on the cascade that you and I call, not perpetual motion, what am I trying to call it? You know what I mean by cascade. Over to you, Glenn. Chain reaction was the word I'm looking for. You got it, Glenn.
Well, here it's referred to as the simple ballistic pendulum. Problems obey the conservation of kinetic energy only when the block swings to its largest angle. So in other words, what this is basically saying, it's not just the minimum velocity. You need the minimum velocity with the largest angle swing. So basically when it catches that largest angle swing is when it's going to collide and then give you that most reinforcement that you're looking for. So it talks about right here, so one of the things you may want to look into is Rutherford scattering, which will give you some background on that one also, and, experiments that were done by the Stanford Linear Accelerator, the SLAC, and look up Rutherford scattering, and I think a lot of the information that you're looking for positive and negative charge, in this particular area of kinetic energy and conservation of momentum with ballistic pendulum motion, that'll probably give you a lot of the answers that you're looking for, Dick.
I'm guessing some of the very earliest particle accelerators may have been accelerating simply electrons. What search word in Google did you use to find the data you're now looking at, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, I first started off with just looking at corona breakdown, and then I was looking for a term that I was, you got to remember, it's been a few years since I've been in college, and here it was now, and I saw, okay, inelastic collision, because I knew it had something to do with that. Then I went back and I started looking up that, and then that led me back to the Rutherford scattering research that was done in the 60s. And that's where basically it explains this with the air resistance, being the square root of the ratio of the height to one bounce. And that's what gives you that angle of that valence shell of electrons and the angle at which it can swing around and then hit the next electron and then give you that chain reaction. So that's basically what I was looking for, was that, looking up inelastic collisions. That's, that's what really, and I started, with looking up, the corona, corona arcing.
One of the very earliest particle accelerators was called a betatron. A beta particle, I think, is an electron. So I'm guessing that betatron was accelerating electrons to some minimum energy that when they hit a target, could now give you a breakup of that target, and then you had particles to analyze with your spectrum analyzer. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, and that probably goes back to your Stanford linear accelerator back in the 1960s.
The betatron was a circular device. The nice thing about the linear accelerator is you don't have to build these super strong magnets to keep steering the particle in a circular path. Now you have nothing but acceleration required and vacuum and some magnets to do focusing, yes, but you don't have to do magnets to do bending. It's these super strong superconducting magnets that are required in the machine that I can't think of the name of right now that's being built in Switzerland, that's being run in Switzerland. These state-of-the-art superconducting magnets are required just to keep that Dawn beam in a circular path.
I think you're going to love this definition, Dick. And this inelastic collision is an interesting thing that you might want to look into. Right now, here's the definition of a perfect inelastic collision. In a perfect inelastic collision, the zero coefficient of restitution in colliding particles stick together, it's necessary to consider the conservation of momentum. And they give you two very, very nice equations right here, and for the velocity. So you can actually solve for your velocity here and the angle all at the same time, and you can find your total reduction of kinetic energy. Definitely Google that. I think you're going to find something you like here, Dick.
Eventually, Eric and I are going to understand. We're going to understand what's the combustion at the molecular level, and that's a tough one. Whether you pass a spark through your spark plug into an explosive mixture and start the process that's called combustion. And I think there's a similarity here with these particles that we're accelerating in an inelastic collision. They've got to have a minimum energy to sustain the chain reaction. Whether that chain reaction be called combustion, or whether it be called an arc with a high voltage effect. And why does an arc give off ozone? And by the way, the ozone of the atmosphere, is that something that we use to control ultraviolet rays, or are the ultraviolet rays causing the O2 to become O3? Does my arc, my high voltage machine, create ultraviolet rays, and is that why it's creating ozone? That doesn't quite fit, because back in the days when all of us were putting screwdrivers across the oil-filled capacitors, we were also making ozone. And maybe we were making ultraviolet rays. And you do get a real big bright spark, and maybe it's the ultraviolet that's doing it. And that's one of the accelerating mechanisms. Pure guess on my part, K2RAW.
Well, there's a lot of compound things that happen in some very, very simple experiments, that's for sure. And somebody's researched it somewhere, and that's the beautiful thing about the Internet. You can always go back and follow up on someone else's research that's probably already done it before. And just an interesting comment about, you know, combustion, that, you know, when you think about combustion in an internal combustion engine, it's really not an explosion, Dick. What's really great is an explosion in combustion is a real nasty thing. That's pinging. So you really don't want to do that. What you really want to do is you want to ignite the gas and allow the pressure to change and increase and move the piston. So you're really searching for the expansion of gases and by igniting them, but not causing an explosion. So you're just holding it right on that very, very hairy edge.
Yeah, I think you're looking for a particular flame front velocity and flame front shape that properly matches the shape of your cylinder and gives you the best possible efficiency of moving that piston. So there's an exact flame front velocity that I think you're looking for to get highest possible efficiency. Let's see if Eric's got some opinions on that one.
Considering what time it is, I don't think I want to start because it's going to take us another hour to...
Okay, we've gone far enough. 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1310 of the series. By now, we must have put to sleep the guys on Dover Street. Let's see if that's true. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Well, I'm just remembering a lot of that physics and all, but can't recall the nitty-gritties at this time of night. And I just wanted to ask you if you got the September issue of QSC, get a chance, take a look at the technical correspondence, and tell me what you think next week about, after you read about the definition of return loss, Dick. And finally, let's see, as my daughter said years ago when she was somewhat, I guess, normal. I put that little fiddles on each side of it. And she was involved with computers and the geeks and her hacker friends and all that stuff. When she was invited out to Microsoft, and she says, "You think I was into computer geeking computers?" She says, "At Microsoft," she says, she spent the weekend there. She says that's a good place for people that sell straitjackets to apply their trade, Dick, over.
Boy, that's fascinating sounding, Mel. What gave Julie the opportunity to go to Microsoft? Was she being offered a job?
Yep. She was selected by Mr. Gates. He was looking for talent. And she was recommended from the school she was going to as top talent. And She spent a couple of years in a business, did quite well, but... Oh, God, I wouldn't even begin to tell you about what went through, what happened. Thank God my wife's sleeping because she's a source of aggravation. So she got a free weekend travel out there and everything. Got all the red carpet treatment, but refused the job and it started with six figures, Dick.
Wow. Do you think Julie would have enjoyed California lifestyle?
She had a boyfriend here. What should I say? And the boyfriend wasn't going to go. No, she stayed here. Then she broke up with that boyfriend. So I said, see what you do. And one day she picks herself up. She says, I've had enough of this computer stuff. I can't sit at this thing no more. Blah, 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 blah. Went crazy. Literally. Went back to school. Became a fitness trainer.
K2Y.
She found a direction, a purpose. Go ahead, Bernie. And we're about to sign off. You've got some great words that are going to allow us to sleep better, Bernie. Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, no, just a minor correction. As a diehard Californian and a self-confessed geek, Microsoft's in Washington, not California.
Well, was there a division in California at the time when Julie went there, Mel?
Olympia, yeah, Olympia, Washington. He's right.
Okay, Bernie, what is the lifestyle like in Olympia, Washington? Would I be super naive if I said, gee, do you get a whole lot of light misting rain there all the time?
Well, every time I went to the Seattle SeaTac area, it did seem to be raining and kind of dreary, so I guess that's why they drink so much coffee. I was a Southern California guy. We always had sun and beautiful skies.
Were you near the Mojave Desert or Los Angeles?
Affirmative. I went to high school and college in the L.A. area, the Eastern Valley, San Gabriel Valley.
And therefore you can sing that song, Born in East L.A.
Actually, had a lot of very good restaurants when I worked in Hollywood. We used to go to East L.A. for lunch all the time.
Did you ever hear of a town called Pico Rivera?
Affirmative, yes, Pico Rivera.
There's some famous things that occurred in that town. Okay, I've got to go away. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. And we're going to settle all these... No, we're going to make an attempt at settling all these issues of physics next week. We won't succeed. We'll hack away at it. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW, clear for listening.
Hey, Dick, good night. I got to say, get a chance if you get the September issue of QSC. Read over the, I always jump to the technical correspondence, and want to talk to you next week about something that's mentioned in the article, okay?
Yeah, I didn't get my September issue yet. I'm a little unhappy about that. Give me a little bit of a hint. You're slightly unhappy with their definition of return loss?
Ed Weatherhold, I know him, my NQN, he did a lot of filter designs. You know, it's like he's seen a lot of his articles on passive filters and so on and so forth. And he was one of those devotees of, using 88 millihenry toroids, those telephone repeater coils, and making filters and all. And he wrote a whole article on return loss coefficients and all. So you've got to read the article first, and then we'll discuss it, Dick. Over.
By the way, guys, you need to measure your filter, come to me.
There's the man with the instrumentation. There was a very elaborate, very high-Q transmitting-type filter with eight cavities to it that I had to align once, had to realign for a brand-new set of frequencies. And I wanted it to have brick wall respond and zero insertion loss across a particular set of frequencies. To do that with a normal network analyzer and try to resolve tenths of dBs in the passband would be very difficult. And for the first time in my life, I looked at nothing but the S11 return loss and tuned for minus 40 dB return loss across the passband, so to speak. And you get a extremely good resolution, as long as you're sure that your filter has very low real I squared R loss, because it's built out of big massive components. By tuning for minus 40 dB reflection coefficient, when the far end of it is loaded with a perfect 50 ohm load, man, is that a nice tuning procedure. Does that go fast? Over to you.
Hey, Dick, I'm going to say goodnight. All right, yeah, I want to discuss that. At the X sub 11, the X sub 21. We'll talk about that next. You got to read the article first before we can go any further. I'll say goodnight to you.
Okay, somebody's calling me on the phone. I'm gone for now.
Good night, Dick. Okay, here you go.
Night, Everett.
Hey, guys. I'm sorry, Jim.
Night, Alex.
Night, everybody. KC2, QIQ.
Glenn.
Good night, all. NY2H.
Dick and Mel, thank you again for all your hard work up in the TechNet. Always an enjoyable Sunday evening. Have a great evening. K2IO, clear.
In writing, because this way a lot more people be more agreeable.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1722 with a release date of Friday, August 13th, 2010. To follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Authorities across the West search for the killers of a ham radio operator and his wife in rural New Mexico. Also, the FCC refuses to make the unauthorized use of ham radio calls a form of identity theft or to expand voice privileges on 15 meters. Find out details on Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1722 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is Jim Davis, W2JKD.
Authorities across the western United States and Canada are searching for an escaped convict and his accomplice who may have been involved in the brutal murder of Gary Haas, N5VGH, and his wife Linda. This after their bodies were found in the burned-out travel trailer in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, has the latest on this developing story.
The badly burned skeletal remains of a couple believed to be Gary, N5VGH, and Linda Haas were found by a rancher in a tar trailer near Santa Rosa, New Mexico on Wednesday, August 4th. State police have confirmed that an Oklahoma couple by that name owned the trailer as well as a pickup truck that was later found abandoned in Albuquerque. New Mexico State Police Major Robert Schilling said on Saturday, August 7th, that 45-year-old John McCluskey has been linked through forensic evidence to the couple's remains. Schilling declined to provide specifics and would not say whether the police think that two other people McCluskey is believed to have been traveling with, Tracy Province and Casey Lynn May Welsh, were also tied to the killing. Province was captured on August 9th in Wyoming. Also arrested was Claudia Washburn, who is the mother of John McCluskey. She was taken into custody in Jake's Corner, Arizona, on allegations that she provided financial and other types of aid in the flight of her son, as well as Province and Welsh. With Province now behind bars, most involved in the search believe McCluskey and Welsh are hiding out in Yellowstone Park, someplace in Montana or Wyoming, or maybe even have fled across the border into Canada. But in a bizarre twist, U.S. Marshals for Arizona say the escaped inmate and his fiancé may be as far away as Arkansas. Authorities there say that a couple who robbed a store in Gentry, Arkansas on Wednesday morning, August 11th, fit the description of McCluskey and Caitlin Welch. Gentry is in northeast Arkansas near Dentonville, where Welch's mother lives. Police are reportedly trying to obtain surveillance video of the robbery. No matter where they are, though, McCluskey and Welch are considered to be armed and extremely dangerous. The two victims, Gary and Linda Haas, were from Tecumseh, Washington. Gary Haas was believed to have been a member of the Tecumseh Amateur Radio Club. According to a search warrant affidavit, obtained by the Oklahoma newspaper. A relative told authorities that the Hawkers were traveling to Colorado on their annual camping trip. The relative also told police they typically camped in state parks and they would often stay near Santa Rosa, New Mexico. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ICF. I'm in the newsroom in Los Angeles.
More on this story as soon as news updates are made available. The FCC has dismissed a request from a California ham who wanted to make the unauthorized use of a ham radio call sign a form of identity theft covered under Part 97 of the Amateur Service Rule. Back in November 2009, Eric Hilding, K6 BVA of Morgan Hill, had filed a petition for rulemaking that requested Part 97 be amended to prohibit the false or unauthorized use of an amateur radio call sign. According to the dismissal order, the petition primarily expressed concern about the misappropriation of call signs on Internet bulletin boards. In his petition, Hilding said that this should be considered a form of identity theft. He proposed that Part 97 be amended to prohibit any misrepresentation or unauthorized use of someone else's amateur call sign over the public airwaves, on Internet packet cluster system postings, cellular or non-cellular telephone connections, electronic-based communications, or print media formats, or any other nature. But in dismissing Hilding's rule change request, the FCC stated that Part 97 regulates only the amateur radio service, and as such, that controlling other forms of communications would be beyond the scope of Part 97. Also, since Part 97 already prohibits amateur radio stations from transmitting false identification, the FCC concludes that the rules already in place address the misuse of amateur radio call signs to the appropriate extent, and that Hilding's petition presents no grounds for amending it. The Federal Communications Commission has turned down a request from a New York ham to expand the spectrum available on 15 meters for phone operation. In his December 2009 petition to the regulatory agency, Richard Ebeling, K2UTC of White Plains, had proposed that the segment of the 15-meter amateur service band authorized to general class and amateur extra class licensees for voice transmissions be increased by 75 and 50 kilohertz respectively. In his petition, Ebeling primarily argued that the frequency segment that amateur radio stations could use for voice communications in various amateur bands. In particular, the spectrum that general class licensees may use for phone emissions in the 15-meter band was increased by 25 kilohertz. The FCC noted that Ebeling's petition did not note that action or otherwise present evidence that the current amount of spectrum in the 15-meter band available for voice communications is inadequate. The ARRL is again saying no to sharing the amateur radio spectrum with public safety robots. On August the 4th, the League filed a petition to deny application with the FCC to reject 68 pending public safety pool license applications associated with Recon Robotics Video and audio surveillance system. Each license application is accompanied by a waiver request to permit operation of the devices in the 433 to 445 megahertz band. The applications were coordinated by APCO International Incorporated Licensing Services and would allow the use of the Recon Scout product currently being marketed by Recon Robotics pursuant to an FCC waiver. APCO International Incorporated Licensing Services is the frequency coordinator for the public service land mobile radio services. Dan Henderson, N1ND, is the ARRL's regulatory information manager. He says that while several issues factor into the League's petition to deny these applications, most notable is that the commission has not acted on an earlier ARRL petition for reconsideration in WP Docket 08-63, which has been pending since March of this year. Henderson said that that petition raises issues that should be addressed prior to any action on the individual application. He says that granting applications based on the docket 0863 waiver, which is not final, would be premature. Henderson goes on to note that there is a potential for significant interference from these devices to licensed operations in the amateur 70-centimeter band. Therefore, the ARRL urges the FCC to take thoughtful and expedient action on our petition for reconsideration. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline. Heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the W3UU repeater of the Harrisburg Amateur Radio Club of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. A to the story of the ham in Midwest City, Oklahoma, who'd been sent a notice by the town last June asserting that he was in violation of a local ordinance regarding radio frequency interference. That ham, now identified as David Box, K5DBX, has been posting on the situation to QRZ.com. And the latest is he reports is good, but not great. The good part is that on the evening of August the 4th, Box says he received an email from Midwest City at the office of its city manager that retracted the notice an order left at his address in June. The bad news is that the city has decided to retain the ordinance as written. Box says that he's provided to the city what he considers to be a more suitable solution through redrafting the ordinance to bring it into compliance with the Communications Act rather than direct conflict with it. He says that he'll have to see how the city will respond and address this portion of the matter. By way of background, you may remember that 2 weeks ago, we reported that ARRL General Counsel Christopher D. Imlay, W3KD, had written to Midwest City's political leaders. Imlay's letter stated categorically that the city had absolutely no legal ground on which to enact or enforce its ordinance. He went on to state that Midwest City's Ordinance 27-3, paragraph 9, which purports to regulate RFI, is preempted on its face by federal oversight and is therefore the city's ordinance null and void. He also expressed his hope that it will not be necessary to submit the Midwest City Ordinance to the FCC by way of a request for a declaratory ruling, but warned that would be the ARRL's planned course of action unless the ordinance is rescinded. So far, Midwest City has refused to comply with Imlay's demand to withdraw the RFI ordinance. But in his letter, retracting the citation issued to Box, Midwest City Assistant City Attorney Randall Homburg says that in the event there are future complaints from any citizens about a neighbor's use of these licensed devices, the city will direct the complaining party to file their complaints with the FCC. Some highlights from the recent ARRL Board of Directors meeting held in Windsor, Connecticut. A major concern to ham radio was a report from General Counsel Christopher Imlay, W3KD, that the recently released National Broadband Plan could affect the amateur spectrum near 2.3 gigahertz. In his report, W3KD noted that nothing is sacred, and even spectrum occupied by the Department of Defense is being challenged. On a more positive note, ARRL legislative consultant John Schwett reports that his office had received more than 2,400 letters from amateurs supporting H.R. 2160 and S-1755. He noted that there are only a few more weeks left in the 111th Congress and that the ARRL must continue its efforts to have the House consider these bills. He also reported on the progress of legislation concerning the tax reduction for personal vehicle mileage on behalf of charitable organizations and the ARRL's effort to avoid impact on mobile operating and distracted driving legislation. The complete minutes of the 2010 second meeting of the ARRL Board of Directors is available on the ARRL website. It's at www.arrl.org. Ham's operating mobile in Montgomery, Alabama, and won a rather narrow partial exclusion to the city's tough new distracted driving law, but only during emergencies. This after the Montgomery City Council passes an ordinance making handheld cell phone use, including texting while driving, a secondary offense. Once the distracted driving ordinance takes effect in the coming weeks, a driver would have to violate one of the primary rules of the road, such as speeding or running a stop sign while using a cell phone, before he or she could be cited for distracted driving. The ordinance does, however, allow for some exceptions. These include someone using their cell phone to report a traffic accident or a crime, emergency personnel, employees of utility companies, and an operator of an amateur radio station are also excluded from the new ordinance, but only as long as their communication devices are being used during an actual emergency. What is not clear is whether the new ordinance applies only to cellular and texting devices or to other two-way radio gear as well. In other words, would chatting on your local repeater with a mic in your hand while driving be considered a distracted driving practice and subject to the new law? And if it does, how would a police officer be able to determine if the ham radio was or was not of an emergency nature, let alone what constitutes an emergency in any given instance? One of the nation's legendary AM broadcast stations was taken off the air Wednesday, August 4th, by the fury of Mother Nature. about 4 p.m. in the afternoon, all three of Wheeling, West Virginia's WWVA broadcast towers were knocked down due to a severe storm and winds in excess of 70 miles per hour. Weather experts say winds at the top of the 400-foot towers could have been in excess of 100 miles per hour at the time of the incident. WWVA first began broadcasting in the 2 a.m. hour on December 13, 1926, using a home-built 50-watt transmitter in the basement of the home of inventor John Strobel. 1 week earlier, the Federal Communications Commission had granted a broadcast license on 860 kilohertz to the radio station WWVA. In May of 1941, the FCC moved WWVA to 1170 kilohertz, and in August of that same year, granted the ultimate power for AM stations of 50,000 watts, and making it the most powerful AM station in the entire state of West Virginia. In reality, the station's three-tower directional array is located in nearby St. Clairsville, Ohio, with its studios in Wheeling. According to a statement on the station's website, engineering crews are working to get some temporary antennas in place as soon as possible so the station can return the programming to the 1170 signal. In the meantime, WWVA's programming can be heard on the 1400 kilohertz signal of its sister station, WBBD, which normally plays adult standards. WWVA is currently owned by Clear Channel Communications. Images of the fallen array are online at tinyurl.com/towersdown. Turning to the ham radio social scene, Southwest Ohio's DX Association president, Don Dubon, N6JRL, has announced the 26th annual DX dinner will be held on Friday, May 10, 2011, in conjunction with the Dayton Hamvention. The new venue for this longtime gathering will be the Dayton Marriott, located at 1414 South Patterson Boulevard. Dubon says that the Marriott has been recently remodeled and has a much larger capacity than the previous location. More information online, www.swodxa.org. The third Asia-Pacific DX Convention, or APDXC, will be held at the Osaka International House in Osaka, Japan, between November 5th and the 7th. Presentations will be conducted in English and will include discussions on some recent DX missions, along with technical discussions. There'll be an opportunity to join a tour to visit the ICOM factory and participate in a technical session led by ICOM High Frequency Radio Design Team. Program details and updates will be posted online, www.apdxc.org, as they become available. And continuing its company-wide update of its magazine websites, CQ Communications has announced the launch of a new and easier-to-navigate website for CQ VHF Magazine. Like the recently updated sites for World Radio Online and Popular Communications, the new CQ VHF site features a cleaner look and a streamlined user interface to make it quicker and easier for visitors to find out what they're looking for. The CQ VHF website update coincides with the posting of the highlights for the summer 2010 issue. Current highlights include sample pages and full-color layouts. This to give prospective readers the ability to see what the magazine itself looks like in print. Also, on the updated site are segments of previous issues dating back to 2006. CQ VHS is a quarterly magazine edited by Joe Lynch, N6DL, devoted to ham radio above 50 megahertz. First published in 1996, it combines articles designed for newcomers with historical and technical features best appreciated by the most experienced VHF operators. You can browse the new web layout at www.cq-vhf.com. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateurs. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org, and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. Digital amateur television is coming to New Zealand, but not necessarily because the Kiwi ham community wants to make the change. Jim Meacham, ZL2BHF, is here with the details.
ATV repeater output down here in New Zealand will soon be forced to go digital if they wish to continue amateur fast scan television operations. this after our nation's telecommunications regulator announced that all analog modulated TV transmissions in the VHF and UHF TV broadcast bands, which includes Channel 39, used by ATV repeater outputs, will close down in March 2015 or at some earlier date. At that time, the upper end of New Zealand UHF television allocation will be cleared of television so that the vacated spectrum can be used for next generation mobile communication. One consequence of these decisions is that the existing television transmissions will need to convert to digital so as to fit into about half of the present spectrum, requiring that their transmission parameters need to be more closely defined than at present. For the amateur television repeater service, this means that each radio license for analog modulated TV needs to be replaced by a spectrum license for analog modulated TV. As part of the process, our government telecommunications regulator has cancelled all of the existing radio licenses for Channel 39 TV repeaters. Operators of Channel 39 TV repeaters need to close them down to avoid receiving an infringement notice from the regulator. Those wishing to operate their analog modulated Channel 39 ATV repeaters during the transitional period between now and the 2015 digital TV switchover need to apply for a spectrum license. However, the spectrum license for analog TV repeaters will only be valid until the analog shutdown date. Ham radio access to New Zealand broadcast Channel 39, which runs from 614 to 622 MHz, was made by footnotes to our telecommunications regulations following WARC 79, when 420 to 430 MHz was taken from the amateur radio service. Amateur TV operation in other bands is not affected. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jim Meacham at L2BHF, down under in Auckland.
As of airtime, it's not known how many of the nation's amateur television repeaters will apply for the new spectrum license to at least temporarily keep their analog systems operational and on the air. Turning to ham radio and space-related matters, the AMSAT Vice President of Operations, Drew Glassbrenner, KO4MA, reports that after a brief outage aboard AO51 on Saturday, July 31st, that the ham radio satellite has been restored to service. The 145.92/435.30 repeater was set to run with a 67 Hz tone required to activate the satellite. Power output was reported as 740 milliwatts. Videos of the presentations given at the recent 25th AMSAT UK International Space Colloquium are now available on the web courtesy of the British Amateur Television Club. This includes a short video produced by the BATV Group showing how club members go about covering events such as the colloquium, using a lot of prosumer-grade audio and video gear to bring you close-to-broadcast-quality pictures and sound. These productions can be viewed and downloaded at www.batc.tv. Simply click on the Film Active icon and then select a 2010 AMSAT video. Amateurs and SWLs across Europe are being asked to keep an ear on or about 28.265 FM. This for transmissions believed to be coming from churches with transmitters capable of delivering a signal strength well over S9. Reception reports and all other information should be sent to the ITTS Intruder Watch Coordinator, Gare McNamara, EI4GXB. His email address is EI4GXB@gmail.com. From the Radio Sports Desk comes word that ICOM UK will again be sponsoring Contest University UK on Saturday, October 9th. This in conjunction with the 2010 RSGB Convention, which will be held at the new venue of Horwood House near Milton Keynes. Now in its third year, Contest University UK is based on a highly successful international format that has seen many radio amateurs throughout the world learn about this exciting facet of amateur radio from experienced practitioners. As such, it's a place where European hams can learn all the skills and secrets to start their journey into becoming a contester and learn some of the secrets to stay ahead of the competition. If you have any questions regarding Contest University UK, please contact Course Director Mark Haynes, M0DXR, by email to mark.haynes@yahoo.co.uk. In DX, word that YJ0VK will be the call of the upcoming DX expedition to Vanuatu. The team is made up of four Australian hams who will be operating from August 27th through September the 2nd on the high-frequency bands from Vanuatu's main island of Ipate. Special attention will be paid to the